Hello and welcome to another episode of Research Goes Viral. My name is Rosina and today I'm accompanied by Natasha Palmalux. We are both PhD students at University of Glasgow Centre for Virus Research. And this week we are joined by Dr. Neeri Arigoyen, and we are going to be having a chat about their scientific career and their personal experiences. Neeri is a group leader at Cambridge University focusing on viral translation and the context of pathogenicity and virulence. So, Neeri, we would like to ask you about what piqued your interest in science, specifically virology, at the beginning. Yeah.
So I think I was always very interested in science when I was a kid. And I remember when I was like, I don't know, like 3 or 4 years. And you know, when you are putting like this kind of piece between like cotton, which is wet, and then you were saying like, how is that going to grow to make a little plant? And I was kind of throwing every day, like how the roots were growing and that thing. And I think that I always like microorganisms. So when I was studying biology at school, I thought it was like very, very interesting. So I always went into that. And I remember, because I was growing up during the 80s, that probably the HIV pandemic was something that really hit a lot. I mean, because I'm from Spain, and that was like during that period, HIV AIDS was kind of a big problem. And I remember like when you were going to the doctor to see all these posters that, well, you should maybe get tested. And so I think that for me, this kind of interaction with viruses and I thinking like what is really happening really make like a mark on me.
Yeah. So, and you started your PhD with the infectious bursal disease virus, and it seems to have, you know, intrigued your interest in other viruses, where you started working with RNA viruses and then many other viruses. So do you think that what was so intriguing about viral RNAs and your understanding of viral infections and all that, which led you to this at the end, the ribosomal profiling and all these things?
So when I started my PhD, it was more about the structural biology and how the capsid of the virus was built and assembled. But at the same time, I was doing like a lot of mutant viruses. So I was very interested into the molecular virology. And by the end of my PhD, I got interested in more into the host virus responses. So when I moved to Cambridge, I mean, during my PhD, I did a couple of short stays, one in Italy and the other one in Cambridge. And then when I was in Cambridge for those 3 months, I started to be working on the translation mechanisms of retroviruses. And I thought, oh, that is very interesting. Yeah. And that is something that I haven't learned before. So I was a bit of a chump trying to like, okay, so I think I know probably not a lot, but I know much about structural biology, and I really want to go into see what the virus is doing in terms of host interactions. I went into translation, and then during that point is when ribosome profiling as a technique appeared. Mm-hmm. So we decided like, okay, let's going to try to check this and see what happens with RNA viruses.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Honestly, for me, RNA viruses are much more interesting than DNA viruses. Maybe this is something I shouldn't be saying. But I mean, they're very small genomes with not a lot of proteins. So mm-hmm. I think it's amazing trying to know what its protein is doing, right? Because they have so many functions. And I find like, wow, that's very, very interesting.
Yeah, that's cool.
So I want to say that you pioneered ribosomal profiling RNA viruses before your paper. It hasn't really been done before. So what do you think, why do you think studying ribosomal profiling RNA viruses is essential to understanding how the replication process is, what the translation like, what's so important about ribosomal profiling?
I think that the technique gives you a lot of information that is unable to be gathered by different techniques, because people would say like, yeah, but I mean, you can do proteomics, right? And see which are the proteins that are translated, and that's true. But that is telling you the proteins or the peptides that are actually stable. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really mean that are going to be like as there might be some peptides that are translated or some regions are going to be translated, but they're only going to have a regulatory function. So that probably you're not going to be able to detect that because that will be degraded somehow. So I think that ribosome profiling is actually just telling you what is actually being translated at that moment is providing you like an extra layer of complexity. And also when you are analyzing the differential gene expression between infected or non-infected cells, we have been always assuming that transcripts that get upregulated, they're also going to be more expressed because you have more RNA. So you would say, but that is not true. And especially not with viruses, where viruses do tend to counteract the translation mechanism and produce this translational shut off. So you can see, and we have seen with our data, that maybe you have this transcript which is extremely upregulated, but then that protein is not translated. So it's telling you more things.
Yeah. So when you applied this first technique, this was in 2016, and you discovered that you are working coronaviruses and you found these new open reading frames. And then later on, you found two new open reading frames in the Brazilian Zika strain. Do you think that we've been missing this across multiple viruses? This is sort of like this unopened box that we've been missing across all other RNA viruses.
Yeah, I think that this is something that is happening much more. It's much more normal than we were thinking. Even when I've been collaborating in some papers like enteroviruses, and they will also be able to find an upstream ORF. And then people are starting to say like, oh, it looks like all these viruses do also have upstream ORFs. And maybe, no, I'm not sure whether all of them, but most of them probably do have. Probably it's a way of kind of regulating how the genome gets translated. I mean, it's not that we are missing, it's that now we have new techniques and we can go into that a bit farther.
Yeah. So you've said this, so one of the common techniques that you do consistently is you do your transcriptomic profile, then you compare that to your ribosomal sequencing. Do you feel that adding another layer of your multiomics, so proteomics, would then add something more? Or do you think that because some of these are not being translated, or that sort of proteomic side is unnecessary with this this type of analysis?
I think that can add some information, at least just to tell you which are the proteins or peptides that are actually stable and which are maybe the only ones that gets translated that might only have a regulatory role. So I think it's good in terms, and also, I mean, with proteomics now, you can also check for differential post-translational modifications that, of course, you cannot check with ribosome profiling. So you are keep adding like extra. I think it would be great if you can do like transcriptomics, translactomics, and proteomics. That would be the best way of
just keep adding.
Yes, keep adding. And if you have a lot of money, and that would be good. If you have a lot of money, you can check for everything, because it's not only how the protein gets translated; it's how it gets modified.
Yeah.
So I mean, and this is something you can only check by proteomics, not by ribosome profiling. So I think that each technique gives you something. The best would be just to use everything, right?
Yeah.
And likewise, you know, AI and machine learning, these are, you know, upcoming hot topics. And so all of the research is just going towards them. Do you think that predictions from these kind of models and artificial intelligence-based predictions, they can help you in identification of more ORFs, or these any strong initiation context for the research you are carrying on right now? So have you ever thought of moving towards these AI-based models in your context?
I haven't thought myself, but I think that is really going to give you a lot of information. Like, I mean, once that we can fit the algorithm with all this, because we know about normal eukaryotic translation, for example, to see what is the best context to something to get translated. But this is something much more obscure for what happens in terms of virus translation, because we are just thinking that whatever happens in a normal cell is going to happen everywhere, but maybe depending on the infection or the stress that the cell is really going to have, maybe that's going to change a bit. So it'd be good to have all these models and to fit them and say like, well, this context or this, this initiation codon AUG in this COSAC context, is it going to be as well translated in terms of infection or not, because then maybe we are surprised that might not be correlated. So
yeah, that's quite interesting, because we have models there that compare these infected and uninfected cells, and then they can predict based on their trainings if something is being upregulated, downregulated, or is expressed or not in certain conditions. So that would be a great idea if you could just think in this direction in that.
And I think it would be very good, for example, why we are seeing, for example, this peptide that has not a very good context gets translated during infection, when you were predicting that shouldn't be like that. So there should be something else, right? And maybe you check, in all infected cells happens the same thing. So, no, I think we are kind of moving into that, right? Even with AlphaFold, we have gone, quite far, you don't really need to resolve the structure of all the proteins. You can try to predict what happens, and then you can work from that.
So, also, I was very much interested. I was reading about you, and then when the pandemic started, during that time, you had the necessary tools. You are a virologist, and you had previous experiences with coronaviruses. So, how difficult was the transition? I read about that you were previously working on Zika virus, and then you shifted again to SARS-CoV-2. So how difficult was that? And then did you have enough, resources and manpower and all those things? Because of the lockdowns, you couldn't have, I assume the collaborations and team things, they were not going that well as they would have been in the normal situation. So how was it for you? The whole time.
So I have to say, I was still working with coronaviruses while the pandemic kicked. I mean, it was not the major point of my lab, but I was kind of wrapping up a paper on coronavirus that in the end evolved into something bigger. So that transition was not super hard, because I was just basically, okay, it's going to recover this box from this minus 80 and put it back into minus 20. So it was good in that sense. It was much worse because, we all were sent home, right? Mm-hmm. For at least, I think I managed to reopen the lab 6 months, six weeks, a couple of months later. Was not super bad, but still I was spending you were feeling I know about coronaviruses, I'm staying here at home, stuck in front of a computer. So I was feeling a bit frustrated with the whole situation. But I managed to reopen the lab, and that was very good. Yeah, it was true. In terms of manpower, the PhD student was sent back home when the lockdown started, so she was unable to come back to the lab. So it was basically the postdoc and me. We were and the beginning was kind of okay, because there were not other people in the lab, so we were compiling with all the measures of being separated and not interacting much with each other, and that was good. When more people started to come to the lab is when everything was becoming much more problematic, because it's when we were having these shifts. And now you need to be coming from 7 in the morning till 2, and the other one between 2 and maximum until 11 p.m. So that was that was tough.
Mm-hmm. And what about the collaborations? I was more interested to know,
So in terms of collaboration, the CAT3 labs that we had, they were super, super busy. So it was almost impossible to get access to them. So I was having a very good friend that actually she was a postdoc here at the CBR, and then she moved to Switzerland, and she was working on SARS-CoV-2, and I basically asked her, I'm going to send you some drugs, would you mind to infect some cells, and then you send me back the samples, and she said, yeah, let's do it, and this is how we did it.
That's
so
amazing.
It worked well in the end, but it was everything seemed to be super slow. It was so many barriers, no, sorry, you cannot do this, and no, this is going to be super busy, and now you cannot work all the time that you need, because
it could be maybe because of the hype of the moment, because everyone wanted results and all the world was looking just at the scientists, and
I think because you tend to forget about these bad things in the end, right? But then it's they think, oh no, maybe it was not so bad, but actually it was awful during the pandemic. So I think it was tough. Because you didn't have access to everything, and even you need to use the confocal microscopy. I was no, you cannot use it, because you need to have this special training, and because there are going to be 2 people, and you cannot be 2 people at the same time. So you need to find someone that has access to this to do that for you. So it was everything that you are trying
independently,
to do.
Because yeah. they can't just, you can't, you're dependent on the other person during the time that you're not there. So
no, yeah, yeah. And I was like, I mean, in the end, you were just managing people on WhatsApp. That was like, oh, show me yeah. your cells to see how they look like. Oh, yeah. So I'm going to take a picture and then you can let me know. So it was like, I mean, that was bizarre, like how we were doing things.
Yeah. So talking about you reopening your lab before, after COVID, you also basically set up your new lab, you were a postdoc in Cambridge and then you transitioned to becoming a principal investigator. So how challenging was that transition to setting up your own lab?
So I think it was good in the sense that I knew the environment.
Okay.
Because I was there, so basically I was just moving like three labs down the corridor, right? So it was not, that was not problematic, and you knew the people. But then suddenly you are the person in charge, right? So you are getting a lot of emails asking you for risk assessments and things like that. It's like, I understand the words and understand what you're trying asking me. So to go into all this bureaucracy was like super, it was a challenge at the beginning, like what are they supposed to be doing? So, oh no, you need to fill this and this and this. So suddenly you have to be just filling forms nonstop. You need to be applying for a lot of funding. Mm-hmm. You start to have people and you need to manage them. And it's not like when you have another PI on top mm-hmm. of you, right? Now you are the last responsible person for that. And that person needs to have a PhD or an MPhil. So they need to have and produce things and you are the last person to be responsible of. So it was challenge. I mean, and there was always going to be a challenge. But then if you add that by the time I was having the PhD student was in the lab and the postdoc was in the lab, the pandemic kicked. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
So actually my lab, like a proper lab, was running like for 3 weeks and then this we needed to close down. And I was like, I cannot believe this is happening.
And that would have been more challenging because you just were managing the students online just from the
yeah,
beginning.
Yeah, and then it was like, okay, so you're back home and we need to find you something to do, right?
Yeah,
and
it
was good that we have all this data for previous analysis that were not actually properly analyzed.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, so you're going to learn how to do bioinformatics and then you can spend your time there trying to analyze this. So that was good. So she didn't feel that she was losing her time while she was at home. But I think we were lacking that because otherwise it's like, what do you do? Because you knew when you were leaving Cambridge, but when are you going to come back?
Yeah.
No one knew that. And it was like, time is passing. So
you had kind of like a unique chance of basically doing your postdoc and then transitioning within the same institution, in the same university. However, in science, it's kind of recommended that you move from two different universities, different institutions, different groups. So how important do you think that is for you, like anyone's career, moving places?
I think it's very important. When I did my PhD, as I said, I went to Italy for 3 months and also I was in Cambridge for another mm-hmm. 3 months. Okay, then I ended up in that lab in Cambridge. But I think that, okay, maybe not the institution because I was in the same place, but I've changed the project a lot. And at some point when I became independent, I was establishing my own collaborations, nothing to do with my previous supervisor. So I was just trying to be as independent mm-hmm. as I could, mm-hmm. trying to separate myself. But I think that it's good, especially when you are training, like when you are a PhD student or a postdoc, to go to different labs because it gives you a different perspective mm-hmm. and you are learning from different techniques or even the same thing, but from different angles. And I think it's very, very good. And also you know more people, you interact with new people, you set new collaborations. So, I mean, if that's an option that you have being PhD student, just take it.
Okay.
In the beginning, it's challenging to learn new, different society, different, ethics and norms in different societies. It's difficult to cope with them in the beginning, but maybe you learn, that all these diverse skills and, you groom yourself up. Just connecting to this point, you are one of the founding members of Spanish Researchers in UK, that association, and you also have been the director, former director, board of directors. Yeah, I was just interested to know, like, what was your aim behind it? Which you might have any ideas, like what led you to create this association? And then also when you came up with the idea, how challenging was it to present that idea before some, you know, authorities and make it happen? So can you share some of your experiences from that?
So I think that comes from because during the economic crisis 2008, Spain was very badly hit.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of people, especially in science, that basically left the country trying to do, okay, as we said, it's good to move around, right? So there was a lot and lots of postdocs going to the UK, and then started a lot of PhD students who started to come as well, because, I mean, funding in Spain was very, very bad. So then is when you realize that at least Spanish community do tend to be quite close.
Mm-hmm.
So we tend to make like not the most open groups, I have to say. Not say it's a good thing. So, but then it's a group of people that have kind of the same problems or the same culture that you had. And you gather like a group of people that have, as I said, the same problems. And if they really want to go back to Spain, how do I do that?
Mm-hmm.
Or how I can succeed in a different country. So it was a good thing to put like everyone together, and also people that came here, you know, like 20 years ago, and they managed to establish their own groups here. So what was their experience and what they were applying for and how they were moving throughout that. So in that was done in collaboration with the Spanish embassy.
Mm-hmm.
That it was like it was a couple of guys in London that were postdocs that were started to lead that, like, well, I think we have this idea. And they started to make calls from the Spanish embassy, like, well, if there is like some other Spanish scientists that would like to join and talk about what do you think, whether it would be a good idea to create a group, please come here. And I read one of these, and I'm maybe it was on Twitter or an email or something. So I decided to go there. And then it's when you start to meet like more people like you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to feel like, oh, so this is more like a community.
Yeah.
So it's when we decided like, okay, so let's going to found this as a group of scientists that are working abroad. And it's going to be more like a lobby in which we can interact between Spanish institutions and universities and research centers, and also with the British ones, and see how we can cooperate. So we started to get like not more famous. Everyone knew about that, and we have like funding bodies in Spain and also in the UK that's putting money, so we can be keep growing and growing. So we were able to create like fellowships between Spain and the UK, like short fellowships for 3 months. We had a lot of travel grants for people to go to conferences. And we were also doing like training courses for coaching and how to present your work. So that's starting to make like a whole thing apart from that. And we started in the UK, and then it was a new association that was created in Germany following us. And then at some point, I think there are like 25 associations throughout the world. Like, you have the Spanish researchers in Australia, Spanish researchers in Japan. So it's like,
you started a trend.
Yeah, and then you say like, what? How they find so many people? And then you realize that actually it's like, I think there were like 20,000 Spanish scientists in the, like outside Spain, like working in different countries. So that was like very interesting.
Yeah. That's incredible. So you're very active, obviously, in your community, but one that I came across is that you are actually quite popular on Twitter. You've got 15,000 followers, which is no small feat. And you've had, obviously, it's really important for researchers to share with the general public the research they're doing. And I think during the COVID pandemic, scientists were both loved and hated, and I think people tend to take these type of platforms to express their feelings, whether they're good or bad. So I'm sure that you might have been on the receiving end, being quite a significant individual on Twitter. How do you deal with sort of the trolls that
I actually have so many followers because of that. Not the best experience. So when the pandemic started, right, people were asking you, or you were trying to provide your knowledge and trying to make like, okay, so let's going to make everyone to understand what is really happening. But then I think that everyone get was a bit stressed, right, and frustrated, and especially people in Spain that were in a proper lockdown, like not being able to get out. So people were like, everyone was getting like much more polarized, and everyone like was very, very aggressive and stressed at some point. Sure. And I just made a comment on Twitter, and then somehow that was picked by supposed to be a Spanish journalist that was from the extreme right.
Okay.
And then he started to send me all his trolls towards me. So then, and I remember because it was a Saturday night, and then on Sunday it was like a massive kind of explosion between people that were supporting you and sending you a lot of emails like, yeah, I don't know why this guy is just saying these things about you. Yeah, because it was like basically saying that I was paid by the Spanish government, trying to say like how good the Spanish authorities were doing all of that stuff. I was like, I don't even live in Spain, so I'm going to be paid by them. So
trolls don't make sense.
The trolls were starting to send me these kind of very nice messages like, this is all your fault and you are just killing all these people. And I was like, it feels so surreal because everything is like online, right? And then you have like a lot of people supporting you, and then you have like all these people just hating you, and then you're feeling, and then suddenly you are trending topic in Spain, but you are actually in the UK, and it's like, this feels like completely surreal. So it's like, okay, I'm just going to leave Twitter just for a couple of days until this goes down. And yeah, so I think, and the good thing about Twitter is that happens and 2 days later, no one remembers you. So I think it's an experience, not something that you should be experiencing all the time. Also, it changed a bit my approach to Twitter because I said, like, what is the, I'm not going to say anything that's going to be like problematic or that's going to cause a problem because no one, I mean, I'm not paid to receiving these kind of things.
Yes.
So you try to reduce a bit, like, okay, I will try to say things that are going to be like quite plain, not maybe not super interesting any longer, but I mean, no one really wants to have these messages that you should be dead or things like that.
Exactly. Of course. But then did it affect your research abilities as well? Like research questions or your approach towards research, other lab colleagues or something like that?
No, I think it was like, it was fine. I think that everyone's just feeling like this is, it's happening to you, but it's like so outside.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, I don't know, maybe if I were in Spain, I would have been more like scared or something because, but feeling that you were like in a completely different country, it's like that doesn't really feel very real to me, honest.
Yeah. I just have a quick question. Like, are you more based at your bench, like experiments and all those things, or you're more towards, you know, back of the computer managing your lab and all these things?
Well, that depends on the, I mean, I'm doing a lot of computer work that I was not doing before.
Yeah.
And also because you're correcting thesis and writing papers, I mean, you are much more doing all of that stuff. But I want to stay at the bench a bit as well. And I really enjoy this few days that I can spend the whole day at the bench. Oh,
wow. So you still enjoy
it? Yeah, because I because in the end, this is what you were doing science, right? To the experiments, not to be in front of a computer all the time replying emails. So it's... So I like to be a bit on the bench. And also because this is when you really feel when you get the results.
Yeah.
So it's when you feel like super excited that I'm going to see what happens with this. So
that's amazing.
Not sure whether I will be able to maintain that for much longer, but as far as I can do it.
Well, we are running out of time, but it's been really lovely talking to you. I do have just one question, and that is, if you weren't a scientist, if when you went to that doctor and you saw all those billboards about HIV, that didn't spike your interest, what do you think you would have done? Or what's your alternative reality?
Honestly, I think I would have become an archaeologist.
Really?
Yeah. Nice. Actually, I was studying history for a while I was doing my PhD.
Okay.
At some point, I couldn't do
But you know, it somehow it links to your current thing, because maybe from viruses, you're, well, at some point you're studying their evolutionary things and how all these things are coming into present day situation and how they were conserved or whole evolutionarily related. So maybe somehow archaeology.
Yeah, maybe, or something like paleovirology or something like that, right? No, but I think it's super interesting when I found, like, I don't know, in mummies, in Egyptian mummies, and then say, oh, they looked at this person got a pox virus and things like that. So I think that, wow, that is amazing to know these kind of things.
Final very quick thing would be, you're obviously a leading woman in STEM, which is obviously a very hot topic. Is there anything that you would like to say to other women that are currently going at the start of their careers to inspire them? Or, yeah, is there anything that you would like to say to them?
Like, if this is what you want to do, just do it. And don't pay attention to people that might be telling you, like, well, but you need to think if you have a family or if you want to have children. No, just do it. Probably you can deal with everything.
Okay,
It's because I
great.
think that we
Yeah.
can do more things than we think.
That's
Great.
very
And
true.
try, no, and then try to find good mentor and good role models. And then you would see, like, okay, so if these people or this person have made it, you can also do it.
Great. Well,
Amazing.
thank you very much, Neria, for speaking to us today. So just before we go, what is the best way to get in contact with you? Is it your website, Twitter?
So a good way is Twitter, and my account is at Nerea. Otherwise, if you can always drop me an email, and it's ni236@cam.ac.uk.
Amazing. So, thank you again. And so just before we go, my name's Natasha and I'm here with Rosina. And you can find both of us on the CVR website, in the Costello Lab and or by email. We also have Twitter accounts, which is, Natasha underscore CVR.
And Rosina Arif, displaying. That's it.
So thank you again for listening to this episode of Research Goes Viral, and we'll be back with the next one soon. Bye.